Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I'm your host, Pierce Redmond, and you can find all of my work by going to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. Well, with tax day slowly approaching us, the issue of tax resistance has been something that I've been thinking about quite a bit lately. And obviously, there are all sorts of reasons that you might want to resist paying your taxes, but perhaps the most important reason and the most noble cause in the tax resistance movement in general is war tax resistance. And this is the act of not submitting to the government's seizure of your money in order to pay for war and destruction. And to discuss this issue, I've invited on David M. Gross, who is a member of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. He's authored and edited several books on war tax resistance. He runs an excellent website called The Picket Line, which tracks not just war tax resistance, but tax resistance worldwide and shows you how you can do this. And he has been actively resisting since 2006. So, David M. Gross, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Excellent. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of how you can resist war taxes and the methods that can be used and things like that, please tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, how you got started in this movement, a little bit about the NWTRCC, why you decided to do this in general.
Well, I got into this from the time of the beginning of the Iraq War. So I actually started in 2003. And at that time, as the United States was preparing its shock and awe attack, I decided that I wasn't going to be able to live with myself. I wasn't going to be able to look in the mirror in the morning. I was going to have a hard time getting to sleep at night if I continued to pay for it. I knew that the rhetorical opposition that I had to the war that was building, that I was expressing in emails to friends or conversations around the water cooler, was just a rhetorical opposition, and that when I was going to work every day and sending my money to Washington, that I was really a war supporter. And I knew I was going to have to stop doing that if I was going to live with myself. So I quit my job and decided I was going to get below the tax line, wherever that was. And I didn't know where it was. I didn't know much about war tax resistance at all. I just was sort of following a moral imperative. And then I was lucky to discover that there's a whole community of people out there who are doing this. There's support networks. There's an organization with a great deal of experience behind it to help people who are making this sort of decision.
Excellent. And also, this is just something that is going to be kind of in the background of our discussion, but let's just briefly discuss the reality of just how much of your federal income tax goes towards war funding, because there are lots of different statistics out there, and they all come up with more or less the same general picture, but they do come up with different numbers. And for a while, I've been going with the War Resisters League pie chart, which they've produced for several years now, and that essentially breaks it down to around 47% of your federal income tax goes towards military spending. That's 18% is about past military spending, and 29% goes towards current military spending. So, can you just comment on this a little bit and perhaps broaden that picture a little bit to the audience?
Yeah, sure. The War Resisters League pie chart is very good about spelling out the rationale they use and the methodology they use for coming up with their numbers. There's a lot of different ways you can divide up the federal budget. You can include the trust fund taxes, things like federal tax on fuel or the Social Security tax in your figures, or you can decide to leave that out and say because those go to trust funds that are dedicated towards certain sources, they don't really count as part of the discretionary budget. So depending on whether you're talking about just the federal income tax or all of the taxes, or just the discretionary budget or all of the budget, or some combination of those, you're going to come up with different numbers. And there's also different ways of trying to account for the national debt and the interest that's paid on the national debt, which is a pretty significant percentage of our budget right now. Now, some people say that if we didn't have such a bloated military budget, we could live within our means. We wouldn't have this debt. And so they allocate all of that interest payment to the war budget. And other people say, well, no, let's just divide it up more or less the way the budget is divided up and say a certain percentage of that interest debt is related to the military and some of it isn't. So depending on how you divide that line, your numbers will come up a little bit differently also. So if you go to, I think National Priorities Project has its own rundown of the budget. The IRS publishes its own sort of pie chart in its tax guide. I think Mennonite Central Committee might have another one. And they all use a little bit different methodology for coming up with the numbers.
But I guess we can more or less agree that a large portion, if not most of your tax, at least your federal income tax, does go towards military spending. I mean, can we
agree on that? It's an enormous amount. Yeah, it's a tremendous amount. And our military spending in this country compared to any other country on the globe is just outrageous.
Absolutely. Well, so there are lots of different ways that one can go about resisting war taxes. There is, you can resist by refusing to pay the 3% federal excise tax on local phone service, which traditionally has always gone towards funding wars, and that goes as far back as the Spanish-American War, and that's fluctuated over time, but that's one method. You can withhold a token amount and write a letter to the IRS describing why you do this, and of course you can end up withholding all of your taxes. But you use a method, David, that I find really, really interesting, and you call that the DON method, or the Don't Owe Nothing method. And this is something that a lot of people might already be doing or might be very close to doing, and they don't even know it. And this also works entirely within the IRS system. So if you do have a fear that your war tax resistance could get you thrown in jail or other repercussions, this is a method that you can use. So please break down the method that you use and how it works.
Yeah, this one kind of snuck in under the radar in that I don't even think the war tax resistance movement was really prepared for how feasible this was going to be. Over the past several decades, the number of American households that are paying any federal income tax has shrunk by quite a bit. So that right now, maybe about 60% of American households pay federal income tax and the rest don't. And the reason they don't is because there's been an expansion of tax credits and deductions. As Clinton was doing his end welfare as we know it, the payouts in terms of welfare payments were being reduced and replaced by tax credits and deductions. And what this means is that a number of people just dropped off of the income tax rolls entirely. So the DON method is basically joining that 40%. So learning about the tax credits and deductions that are available to you, taking advantage of those, and then lowering your income to a level where you don't owe any federal income tax anymore.
And this is, again, like I said, this is totally legal. You go into it on your website through a step-by-step process where you can, you can put money into certain things like an IRA or a 401k, and this will also sort of shift the money away that acts as a credit. And more or less, it's just lowering your general income. And as you said, most Americans are already doing this. Now, when you went about doing this, what were the sort of effects of this? Did you really see that your life was sort of turned upside down by lowering your general income? As you said, you quit your job. What did you do to support yourself?
Well, I went from being an employee in my line of work to being a contractor. And so that way I had more control over my hours and my income. I expected it to be much more disruptive than it was. When I first started doing it, because I didn't know where the tax line was, I didn't know much about these deductions and credits, I was really expecting the tax line to be somewhere around the poverty line and for it to be a really challenging thing for me to learn to live, on a much lower income. And I thought I was going to be, scrambling for food and having a hard time making my rent payments and the like. But as it turns out, once you figured out some of these deductions and credits and know how to use them, you can live at a very comfortable level on a below the tax line income.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say that most of the people that I know that are my age are certainly living below this. And while it's difficult at times, it's not impossible. And I know that you've come up with some creative methods, again, to avoid a lot of the federal excise tasks. I know you homebrew your own beer. Is that correct?
Yes.
And is there a large federal excise tax on that, or is that just another sort of way of avoiding it?
No, it's small. It's about a nickel a bottle. So you go to the store, you buy a six-pack, you're going to be paying a nickel for each of the six. So it isn't a great deal of money. It's not like you're going to be launching a warship every time you go out and have a drink. But symbolically, it's nice. And it's also something where I can bring it along to activist gatherings and say, here is my federal income tax free beer. Let's each have one and we'll talk about taxes and their effect on the military.
Mm.
It's a visible way of resisting. It's a way of demonstrating your resistance. It's also definitely a way of making friends when you're passing out beer. And also just it's fun to make beer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I noticed on your website you also talk about some of the sort of benefits of not being there's so much consumerism here in America, and you can debate the pros and cons of that, but I think that the bottom line, I mean, we live in this society where you're constantly being berated with ad men telling you that you need to buy stuff, most of which you don't need. And I think that many times you're also supporting a lot of these massive multinational corporations and globalist business entities, which also profit from war. So the idea of sort of taking a step back and figuring out, how can I live my life without the next new iPhone or this or that is also another really good thing just in general. I mean, you can do that without having any sort of war tax resistance notion in your brain.
Yeah, I very much agree. And I think even if war tax resistance were no longer my motive, I would still be wanting to live this lifestyle of bringing in less income, spending less money. I thought it was going to involve a lot of sacrifice and difficult choices. Instead, it's really enriched my life. I have got more time. I'm doing more things that I think are more valuable. I have more variety in my life. I have time to do things like learn new hobbies, learn to cook, learn, do the shopping and recipe hunting and kitchen cleaning and all that it takes to be a home chef and have a lot of fun with that. Whereas before, I'd get home from work and be really tired and just want to go out and grab something.
Mm.
There's just a lot of good reasons why stepping off the hamster wheel is good for you, good for the planet, and keeps you from contributing more to the horrible mess that's going on in Washington. Because it's not just the taxes that you pay. It's the taxes that get paid as your money circulates through the economy. When you buy something from a corporation, how much are you paying in excise taxes? How much are you contributing to their corporate income tax? How much are you paying in customs fees and things like that for the raw materials that were brought in from overseas? Mm. So the more that you reduce your consumption, the less you're going to be contributing to the whole wealth of ways that the government sort of leeches off of the economy.
Mm. And perhaps now we could briefly talk about some of the dangers of tax resistance, because, for any of the listeners that may want to go a step further, I think it's important to understand the reality of what you're doing. I know there's also quite a bit of disinformation out there in terms of the repercussions that can be brought against you for tax resistance. Now, I think some of my listeners may be somewhat familiar with people like Randy Keller, who had his house seized for back taxes. Juanita Nelson is very famous, who was imprisoned for a short period of time for refusing to provide records to the IRS. But David, what are some of the realities or dangers of war tax resistance?
It all depends on your method. And one of the nice things about war tax resistance is there are lots of different methods. In fact, sometimes we remark that there seems to be a different method for every resistor. And what that means is that you can sort of pick and choose which risks you're willing to take. And you can know what those risks are ahead of time and can take steps that you need to take to mitigate those risks. So that makes it a very, very nice way of doing activism. It's controlled. You know the risks ahead of time. You can make a plan to confront them and deal with them. And also, the way the IRS operates, it's really mostly just interested in getting the money. It usually isn't interested in making an example of you or punishing you or being vindictive against you. It just wants the cash. And so for most resistors, at any point in the process where the confrontation with the IRS gets too scary, they can just bail if they want to. So you can press it only as far as you want to press it. So there are different risks for the different methods. At the low risk, low commitment level, a lot of the risks have to do with, am I risking not going far enough? If you're paying under protest, for instance, you may feel like, but the risk here is that I feel like I'm doing something, but I'm not really doing anything, or that my protest really isn't being heard. If you resist a token amount, like some people will resist $10.40, and that just is a way of saying, you know, look, I'm putting something on the line here. I'm saying no to a small extent. I'm not willing to really have the whole wrath of the government come down on me, but I just wanted to let you guys know that I'm not going to play ball 100%. And that again carries the risk of, is it really having an effect? And, you know, there's risks of war tax compliance, just as there is of war tax resistance. If you pay what's owed and you do everything that the government tells you to do, you run the risk of getting to the end of your life and going, my God, I was a good German. I was just going along, you know, and you don't want to be that person.
Absolutely.
As you ramp up the resistance to more and more confrontational levels. If you say file your return, but don't pay a dime, or if you don't file at all, then it's easy to get on the government's crap list. And then what they'll usually do is send you a lot of letters in the mail, or their computers will send you a lot of letters in the mail. And over time, those letters will get more boldface and more exclamation marks in them. And then eventually you'll get one that says, we're going to try to levy some of your property. Here's the official announcement. We're going to go after your stuff. And then sometimes they just kind of drop it at that point. Other times they go and they look for your bank accounts. They look and see who's paying you a salary, or if you're a contractor, who's been sending you 1099s. And then they go to those people and say, give us the money. So they'll seize it from your bank account, or seize it from your salary, or have your clients send the checks to them instead of to you. If you don't file, there are failure to file penalties that get added onto your bill. If you fail to pay, there's interest and penalties for that as well. They aren't enormously daunting, but they do add up over time. So those are also things that you risk. Risking jail or property seizure is very, very rare for war tax resisters. I mean, there are tens of thousands of us out there. And before I came on the show, I looked up. We keep a list on the NUTRIC website of all war tax resisters who've been taken to court. And since 1990... there are 4 cars that have been seized and 2 homes, and 8 war tax resisters have gone to jail. And the longest sentence was 27 months. The average was about 9.5 months. So, I mean, the odds are that's like less than 0.1%, I think, of the war tax resisters out there have even been taken to court. And usually those people are the ones who have been very confrontational and have pushed it and pushed it and pushed it.
And also, I mean, I know you've talked about this on your site, in your book as well, that there is a really powerful community out there that you may not be aware of in terms of war tax resistors. And, you know, there are all sorts of examples of this throughout history where people's houses were seized and the community went and was able to buy the house back. I know that's happened with cars. They'll try and seize your car. And then you'll get a group together. So there is really a very vibrant community out there. And that's another issue with war tax resistance. I think if you really want to get in this, you have to be willing to help out the fellow resistor. Because, you know, it may not be that big a deal. Oh, they're hassling you or whatever. But you need a little bit of support if you really want to make this happen.
Yeah, I definitely recommend anybody who's interested in starting war tax resistance or is curious about whether it's right for them to get a hold of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. Kind of a clumsy name, but the website is the acronym NWTRCC.org. And you can find information there about the various methods of war tax resistance, the various risks involved. You can find out that there's a network of counselors, one-on-one counselors around the country who can meet with you and help you out. So they've got a great deal of information. It's a very good community. They put out a newsletter every other month that keeps people up to date on, you know, various changes in the IRS policies and tactics, changes in the laws, experiences people are having across the country, and ways in which people are resisting. People are always inventing new ways of augmenting their resistance.
Well, I guess we can't discuss this without sort of discussing the political side of this. And there is this notion, you know, this sort of very knee-jerk reaction to, you know, let's just take war tax resistance, get this sort of conservative, oh, well, you hate America. And then you'll get the kind of liberal knee-jerk reaction, which is, oh, my God, like, you know, you don't care about the poor or about roads. And how dare you resist your federal income tax? So, and for me, the way I see this, this isn't really a left-right issue. This is really, do you want the majority of your federal income tax going towards building a new drone that's going to fly over Yemen? But perhaps you can kind of broaden this out, because there is actually a much more broad coalition, and it's not just the anarchist movement, but it is people on the left, on the right. There are numerous religious groups, Mennonites, Quakers. So, you know, perhaps you can kind of broaden this out and really kind of speak to the idea that this isn't really, either love America or hate it, or hate taxes or love them.
Yeah, the movement is ideologically diverse. So we have people who are libertarians and anarchists who don't feel at all any compunction about keeping money away from the state in general. And we also have a lot of progressives in the group who believe in the government as a force for good and think that it ought to be supported in general, but just think that the fact that it's become so militaristic and the military budget is so large has put it over the line and made it impossible to conscientiously support it in its current form. And people who want to express that they're very willing to continue to financially support good projects in their community, they just aren't willing to do it through the means of the militarist government, will often redirect their taxes. So they'll fill out their tax return as normal. It'll give some amount that they're supposed to send into the Treasury, and they'll write the check, but they won't send it to the Treasury. They'll send it to some good cause that needs it. And that's a way of saying, you know, look, I've got priorities. The Pentagon's got priorities. Congress has priorities. I think I trust mine better.
Yeah.
And who doesn't really?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, that's another sort of, of course, we could get into a whole philosophical debate about the nature of the state. But I think it's pretty fair to say that, to those in the audience and out there that do think that the government has a good intentions at heart, I think it's fair to say that for the most part, I mean, the government here has become so militaristic in nearly everything. And this is we're not just talking about foreign wars. I mean, we can talk about the police state as it exists here, the sort of just disintegration of civil liberties. And it really comes down to, do you want your money, the money that you earn, going towards that?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to decide, you know, you are currently supporting the government if you're paying it taxes. It isn't a matter of them taking it from you invisibly. It's a matter of you're going to work and a certain percentage of your working day, you're working for the priorities of Congress's spending. And so it's kind of beholden to you on you to examine that and say, is this what I want to be doing with my life? Is this what I want to be contributing to? Your contribution is important. Otherwise, they wouldn't, you know, be trying to get it out of you so hard, right? Mm. And so in the same way that your contribution is important to keeping the system going, your refusal is an important way of saying no. It's an important way of saying no. Things are going to have to be different from now on. It really is a practical sort of activism in the way that carrying signs in the street seems to be less and less so.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because my personal opinion of protests is that it might be a good gesture, and it is certainly a way to kind of garner attention, be it in the media or whatnot, for a brief moment. But ultimately, you know, we can all walk in the streets and hold signs about not wanting to go to war and you know, name a country. And to some degree, that kind of works. You know, we sort of saw that with the recent buildup in Syria. But what I like about war tax resistance is that it's really – you're actually resisting. You're not just sort of talking about it. And I think a lot of people go to rallies and they think, oh, yeah, I really stuck it to the man this afternoon. And then, of course, they go home. They turn, you know, they turn on the TV and they zone out. And that's not to say that, you know, watching TV is evil. But I think that the really war tax resistance for me is such a powerful statement. And even if it's just, you know, one individual person out there who listens to this decides to do that, I still think that you're making a very bold stance. And of course, you know, if we got a lot of people to really do this, you would see something. I mean, the government would have to react on some level.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and there have definitely been cases. There have been countries in which enough people have started resisting taxes and decided that the tax system was illegitimate in some way, that it has forced policy change. I mean, I don't think we're anywhere near that stage right now in the United States, but that doesn't mean it can't happen here. It's happened many times in history before.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just it's something that you can do, and you know, your method kind of lays it out in a very simple way. And you know, I'm going to throw it out there that in the economic period that we're living right now, it's not that difficult to, if you really feel strongly about this, it's not that difficult to get below the poverty line. And that's a very simple way that you can do it. And you know, as you've said, I mean, this you consume less, so you're not aiding these big corporations. You end up interacting much more with the people around you, which is something that is slowly fading away as well. Well, you know, we're stuck in our iPhones and whatnot. And this, I think, really does make something more of a difference in terms, you know, as opposed to say protesting in the streets, holding up signs.
Yeah, let me correct one thing you said. It's not the poverty line that you need to get below; it's the tax line, and the tax is considerably above the poverty line. So you shouldn't feel shouldn't feel daunted by the word poverty. It's not that bad, really.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, this is a way. I mean, that was at a rally in San Francisco, where it was a rally in front of Nancy Pelosi's office there at the Federal Building. And these were people who were going there and holding signs and demonstrating and trying to convince Nancy Pelosi to lead Congress to cut off funding for the war in Iraq. And I looked around at the audience, and I happened to know that Nancy Pelosi wasn't in the building that day. But I asked them, I got up and I said, well, what would you say if you had a chance to go in to talk to Nancy Pelosi? And you told her that it was so important that she cut off funds for the Iraq war. And she leaned over the desk and looked at you and said, you first. What would you do? Mm. I mean, if we need to lead by cutting off our own funds, and then Congress will follow. We can't expect it to do the work for us. We really have to get out in front of this. You know, we have to be the ones who take the democracy back, basically, and say, if this is going to be our country, we have to start leading it.
And I mean, of course, most of the politicians in Washington are already beholden to the war machine already. I mean, in California alone, I mean, there are just so many little tiny congressional districts where you've got all sorts of military-industrial complex funding going in there. So if you really, you know, expect that writing a letter to your congressperson or your senator is going to make much of a difference, I think war tax resistance is a much stronger method to go about doing this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, David, is there anything else you want to close on? I mean, I'd also like to know your thoughts on the sort of state of perpetual war that we're in right now. You know, I've been asking this of a lot of different guests and talking about geopolitical things and about war. But how do you see this as forming here in America? I mean, at least for me, I mean, I see the militarism reaching a really just a fever pitch. It's so in your face. I mean, it's in every, you know, sporting event that you go to or watch on TV. It's in, you know, celebrity culture is so heavily militarized. What's the direction that you see this going in? And, you know, what can we do about it?
I'm not particularly optimistic. I think we have to start slow. The fact that it doesn't even seem to be a matter of public debate that we're a global empire that has military bases everywhere, that we're so militaristic in our nationalism, and that we at our sporting events we'll have jets fly over and we'll have the military march out with the flag and everybody stand up and salute it, and these things that to me seem very ominous. To the people around me, don't even seem to be something that's an issue. It's not even a topic of conversation. So I think we may need to start very humbly at just trying to sort of reintroduce this and ask people to imagine what it would be like to be in a country that was not this way, that was, you know, a little bit more humble and not wanting to rule the world or be the global policeman. Mm. You know, what that would feel like. One of the ways that people in the war tax resistance movement often try to make that conversation happen is we'll find some item, some huge item in the military budget, a new jet fighter or something along those lines, and say, this is what that costs, and here's what else we could be buying with that. Mm. Which one is more valuable to you? And that kind of gets the conversation going. Another thing is, on tax day, all around the country, war tax resistance groups will start these things called penny polls. And this is a way to sort of ask passersby to vote on their priorities for the budget. So they'll set out jars, one marked military, one marked education, one marked environment, one marked judiciary, or what have you, and give everybody 100 pennies and ask them to put them in the jars according to how they would like to see Congress spending our money. And then comparing the heights of the pennies in those jars with a bar chart showing how the government's really spending that money. Mm. And it's a way of starting that conversation, because nobody really wants to be spending that enormous amount of money on the military. They're just not really conscious that it's going on. And they're not conscious that that extra half hour they spent before going home to their family was a half an hour they were spending pretty much 100% to support the Pentagon's priorities. And they're doing that every day. If they can translate that into their own lives, like, I'm spending an enormous amount of my life supporting a bloated, you know, pork projects and wars overseas that I don't agree in and the like, then that can start to erode the sense that, oh, it's just the way it is. It's just the way it's got to be. We're America.
Mm, of course. And it's also, I mean, it's just so, you know, you would never in a million years run your own household like this. And, you know, just the way that they spend money just left and right. It's so insane. But David, please, before we wrap up here, please tell the listeners about your website. It's excellent. There's so much information. It's a very unique looking website as well. I know you have a new book, 99 Tactics of Successful Tax Resistance. So please tell everybody about that.
Okay, my website is at sniggle.net/TPL. That's the picket line. Mm. And it's a blog at which I'm sharing my research about tax resistance in general, including war tax resistance. My new book, 99 Tactics of Successful Tax Resistance Campaigns, which you can find out more about at sniggle.net/99T or 99 Tactics, is a book about tax resistance as it's been practiced around the world and throughout history in a number of causes. So some of this is war tax resistance and other conscientious objection to government spending. But these are also people who've used tax resistance to enforce civil rights, like in the women's suffrage movement, or Gandhi in South Africa, or in the course of a nationalist independence campaign. The U.S. Revolution was in part a tax resistance campaign. Gandhi's campaign in India was a tax resistance campaign. What's going on in Catalonia today is a tax resistance campaign. Preventing robbery, just flat out people who are using the tax system to enrich themselves at others' expenses. So the Addio Piso movement in Italy right now, which is getting businesses to boycott the mafia, is a variety of that movement. Combating corruption in government. In the United States during the Great Depression, Chicago engaged in a property tax strike that lasted several years because some rich and connected property owners somehow managed to get their property not listed on the rolls, and they won. Combating taxes that are illegal, that the government has inflicted on people without any sort of legal authorization, or advancing the democratic control of government. So going on in the Reform Act of 1832 in Great Britain, for instance, the Breton Association in France, what Karl Marx was doing in Germany back when he was a Democrat. So tax resistance has been going on all over the world. It's been going on throughout history, and we can learn the lessons of those campaigns to make our campaigns more successful, because a good tax resistance campaign is not just going to contain tax resistance, but it's going to also support current resistors. It's going to increase the ranks of resistors. It's going to frustrate government countermeasures. It's going to expand the arsenal of techniques so that the more the government goes after a certain variety of tax resistance, the more you can come up with new varieties they haven't thought of yet. It involves tactics of education and propaganda. And it also involves you have to kind of keep in mind what your vision of victory is for your campaign. What is it going to mean to say, I've won? Okay, we've done it. Because there's different ways of victory. It's not always a showy, flashy thing. Sometimes it's very subtle. So anyway, my book goes into all these tactics in depth and shows you examples of how they've played out in history all around the world. And so when you have a campaign going, you can refer to this and you don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. You can learn what's worked for campaigns in the past and apply it to your campaign in the here and now.
Excellent. Sage advice to anyone out there who is concerned about this. And we'll include the links to where you can buy the book. I know you also have a sample chapter up as well, and we'll include that. David M. Gross, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. And I'm sure that we'll be talking to you again, as I don't see this issue as going away anytime in the near future.
Anytime. Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, everybody, so that was my conversation with War Tax Resister David M. Gross. I really do hope that you check out his website and the links that I provide. War Tax Resistance is something that's really fascinating and can really could really make a difference if people really understood what it was about and understood just how much money the government is forcibly taking from you to fund all sorts of horrible things, not just war. I'd like to also give a quick thank you to Ruth Benn, who is the coordinator of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. She was so helpful in getting me in contact with David. And, you know, she's just part of a great organization. So thank you a lot, Ruth, for everything that you did for this episode. Well, I hope you enjoyed this. And if you did, then please visit porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. And there you can find all the episodes free for download. You can stream them off the website. Of course, follow me through the RSS feed or through email blasts. Always follow me on Twitter at Porkins Policy, and also please do subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/1138Porkins. Well, I hope you enjoyed this. Hopefully this episode will be out before my appearance on Tom Secker's Clandestime. But if not, I'll be on that pretty soon, so you can listen to me there. And great numbers so far on the website, everybody, and it's been really great. And again, I just want to urge everybody out there, if you listen to this, if you like the show that I'm doing, then please, please tell a friend, email it, put it on your social media, get it out there, because it really helps me a lot, and I appreciate it so much. And, you know, if you want to send me an email, that's fantastic as well. Even if you don't like me and you want to just yell at me, that's perfect also. So with that, I will leave it there, and I will talk to you very soon. We'll be right back.